Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're all here. Wade, welcome back from your little day off. Apparently, you're preparing for Christmas. Got your flannel and your beard going. It's good.
Right.
And I'll just make a quick comment. The anarchy of the shirts is really taking a turn for the worst. But we're all here. It's good to see everybody. Jason Eisengrind, retired executive from HHS OIG, retired UPIC West director and dog corraler here. Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart from HHS OIG, the Northeast UPIC director, a member of our SIU team, and Wade McFowl, the retired ASAC out of the Los Angeles field office and now a member of our SIU investigative team. So we're here. We're going to spend the next little bit talking more about sort of the SIU, the UPIC world from the investigative perspective. I want to talk about the trials and tribulations of trials and hearings and things of that sort, whether it be depositions or the like. And I think that, you know, one of the areas we get asked a lot about and we do a lot of training for SIUs is sort of in that world. It's preparing for trial. It's being able to be comfortable giving testimony. It's being comfortable in giving, whether it be trial testimony, deposition testimony, and things of that sort. And, you know, it all starts with having a solid case file. And Jason, I'm going to start with you because you harp on this all the time. And we were just joking before we started this recording about how there used to be that phrase over at the Office of Investigations about being administratively pure, which really meant that you followed the policies and procedures to the absolute letter with no vacillation whatsoever. But there is an important piece of that, which is, having a well-documented, comprehensive file that really tells the story and that things are submitted in a timely manner, right? And, you know, you had a number of trials when you were at the OIG and when you were over at the UPIC, you were spending a lot of time dealing with interviews and testimony and helping to support trials along the way. So, you know, what is your big take home? You're preparing for a trial and you've got a ton of documents and write-ups that need to be done or that should have been done or could have, would have been done that were done. How do you kind of determine what is the stuff that's important versus not important when you're going through that case file?
Well, I guess it begins with the realization that you're not just a finder of facts, but you're also a presenter of the facts. And as you're going along building your case and you're having all kinds of fun doing on-site interviews and securing information and evidence that's going to prove, or I always like to point out, prove or refute the allegations and then move on to the next great investigation, you have to be documenting in a contemporaneous manner the good work that you're doing. Because if not, you can have some of the best facts that you found, but they're going to fall very short in terms of proving the allegations later on. And so humorously, having worked with you, Eric, when you first started, I had a realization that, gee, I wish I had taken typing someplace along the way, because it was at that time in the 90s where electronic case files were starting, or at least, you know, you were responsible for doing your own typing in the very beginning. And typing with two fingers doesn't lend itself well to a 4-page interview report. And I will also say that along with doing the documentation contemporaneously, do it in a manner that's going to support your position when you're asked to prove it. And so, I mean, a somewhat maybe a little bit of a kooky anecdote, I always remember a time where a very good FBI agent that I was working with had we had made our arrests of the two primary subjects, and you know, they actually spoke to us afterwards and whatever. And I wasn't at the interview that the FBI agent did. I was at the other subject's interview, obviously. And in his 302, the infamous interview report that the FBI was generating, he asked the subject the question, and then he, in a colloquial manner, wrote that, and you know, he didn't think that the subject was being truthful, so he pushed him on it. And I think there was about 20 minutes of the defense counsel asking, like, what degree of physical interaction did the pushing the subject on it. So you know, as I mean, I'm sure, you know, people hearing that are thinking, oh, come on. Just again, having experienced dozens of situations like that, you just have to realize what you write down in that contemporaneous memorandum is going to be the subject of discussion later on. So you want to be accurate and I guess it's redundant, but and clear. So things can be accurate, but not necessarily clear. I would highly recommend that you use the write-up to be substantive in nature, obviously no opinions. And then I highly recommend bullet points so that you are just communicating the bare fact as opposed to, you know, other words that potentially look good on paper for a narrative, but the reality, it doesn't add any substance to the report.
Yeah, I mean, look, none of what we're talking about is meant to be legal, regulatory, or any advice other than friendly, professional advice based upon our years of experience, right? So at the end of the day, you know, all of this is going to be vetted out through whoever the lawyer is that's involved with resolving this matter, whether this be criminal, civil, or administrative. I do remember that story that you told about that, you know, where the term, you know, pushed him was. And, you know, my similar story was, you know, and one of the things that we talk about a lot when we do our process improvement, our training at the SIUs is the person who wrote the notes writes the report. You should never give your notes, your musings, your thoughts, your comments to someone else to interpret, because at the end of the day, one or two words could have a pivotal change in meaning. And so the person that takes the notes is the person that writes the report. And, you know, we've had instances where oftentimes we've learned that SIUs were not doing that, that the person that was writing the notes was not the person writing the report. And we've got at least one SIU that we've instructed to change that as a policy, because the person that's writing the report should be the person who has the understanding of what those notes are. Whether you're using hieroglyphics, code, acronyms, whatever it may be, there should be no interpretation. And it should just be that factually based thing. And, you know, we did at one of our recent on-site trainings that we did with one of our SIU plans, we spent a block of time talking about the mechanical writing up the interview report with using things like headings and bullet points and the like, because that does have probative value when you're trying to go back and recreate it. The piece that I'll put in on that is that when you are writing up those notes, you talk about it contemporaneously, and the importance of that contemporaneousness is that you don't want to have a situation where you've taken all of these notes, you didn't write up the report, it's 6-8 months later, and you now have to write up that report. And now what's going to happen is, even if there's nothing factually incorrect in your report to the notes, you've now given a lawyer cannon fodder to spend 15 or 20 minutes doing nothing other than bothering you and rattling your confidence by questioning you about why did it take you 8 months to write up a report that was 3 pages of notes. So it's the contemporaneous piece. Can't be stressed enough. At the minimum, even if there's nothing of substance that vacillates from the notes to the interview report, while it is substantive, it's not a verbatim. You know, why give a lawyer an opportunity to spend 10 or 15 minutes or however long they want to spend questioning you about a date difference, you know, on something when nothing else seems to really be of any value. So, you know, with that, Wade, I want to go to you because one of the things from a supervisory perspective is enforcing that, right? So at OIG, there was actually a policy about, you know, that you had to have written up your report within 5 days unless there was some extenuating circumstance. And even in the SIU space, there are policies about writing up these things and that need to be contemporaneous. So from a combination of from a management perspective, but even from your personal work, it's how do you keep your tempo to be able to manage that, right? Because if you have a day where you've got 10 or 15 members or beneficiaries or whatever the plan is calling them, you've got to then write those up. And so the problem then becomes from an investigative perspective, the time management becomes a little bit of a challenge, right? Because you've spent, you know, you spent a day interviewing people and now you have to spend a day or more, you know, on those write-ups.
Yeah, and I would back up to what you were saying, excuse me, on the OIG side of things. It probably only takes one or two times where you fail to write up your interview for an extended period of time, you know, like you said, a couple weeks or even a couple months, because depending on how you take notes, you're going to have things in your notes that you're going to say, I don't know what that even means if it's months later. So I think it's a good practice, and I always encourage my agents to do it within, not only within the time frame because that's policy, but even if you can't finish the interview, like you say, if you're doing a lot of interviews, at least get a rough draft, get every note that you have on your notes, have that somehow documented in your interview. You can come back later and make it flow better. You can, you know, work on the grammar, you know, focus on, you know, who your audience is, you're writing for. Ultimately, you're writing for a jury and not for attorneys and defense attorneys. So as long as you get those facts, anything that you wrote down in your notes at the time you thought it was important, so that should probably be somewhere in your notes. So just it can be a super rough draft, but get something on paper. And if you have to come back to it later to dress it up, that's fine. But also, as what you're saying, I would avoid scheduling too many interviews in a row where you're not going to have the ability to write them later. So only schedule like two or three interviews one day. And it depends too, because some interviews might take 5 minutes and you can write them up in 5 minutes. Some, you know, especially if you're looking at like a proffer or something like that, some interviews can take 3 hours, 4 hours, and you might have 10 or 15 pages of notes. Something like that's going to take a day to write up probably. So you really have to look at that with your scheduling. It doesn't make sense to go out and conduct, you know, 15 interviews and then say, I got, you know, 2 weeks of write-ups here, because some of the facts will cross over. And so I think scheduling is a big part of it too. As far as the SIU world, what I see, and it could be different for different investigators, but I haven't seen any interviews like the ones that we did with the OIG. The ones that I see are more, if it's specific to a member, you're really trying to find out a couple things. You know, is this service correct? Is this what actually happened? Was it this day? Was it this doctor? There's a few, it's like almost like a checklist interview, and those are easy to write up. A lot of times you can almost do just like a questionnaire. It doesn't have to be a narrative type interview. But importantly too, what I think Jason brought up early on, going back to the OIG days, like early on, we did mostly narratives. It had to be a story, you know, start with it's time set or time, not time sensitive, but it's chronologically presented. And after the days of the Dr. Knoll training, I think it was huge, because that's when we went into just bullets are more effective. They're quicker to write up. There's less, you know, room for misinterpreting, you know, a nice fluffy narrative. So I think using those techniques going forward was very effective. But another thing on the interviews, I think we have to focus on is you never want to have to go back and say, okay, now now we're going to trial. The interviews should always be focused on, at some point, they should be trial ready. So they need to focus on intent and those types of things that you need for trial. You don't want to have to get to a situation where, oh, now we're going to trial, so now I have to go back and redo these interviews because I wasn't focused on intent or whatever we're trying to prove in trial. So even though they're not going to be, the case won't be trial ready, I think it's important to focus on really the end game and on what the interview is like Jason's saying, that is telling a story. What's the story you're trying to tell? And usually that is going to include some element of intent. So that should be focused on from the get-go up front, really.
Yeah, the time management piece is an important piece. You got to think in terms of if you schedule to go out and do 15 interviews, even if they're on the telephone, that what are the collateral consequences from that time management perspective? So, you know, does doing 3 interviews and then writing them up that day and then doing 3 more the next day get you to where you want to go? I think one of the biggest things that comes up constantly in conversation is the premise of re-interviewing people. And this is where you've got to have that preparation. And we talk about it all the time, the 3 P's: preparation, preparation, preparation. Because what you don't want is a situation where you've interviewed someone and then you got to go back 3 months later and talk to them again, and their story is not consistent with what it was. And it's a little bit like if you've got 2 documents, which is the right document? Well, which story is the right story? And that consistency needs to be there. So that preparation helps to alleviate some of that instance of having to re-interview. And I think the important piece is that if you have to go and re-interview someone, that you're re-interviewing them only with respect to a very specific piece of the puzzle that was missing, that you're not rehashing the conversation so that you have inconsistent statements from people. And inconsistencies aren't necessarily bad. People's memories fade over time. People have different recollections over time, things of that sort. So, you know, having that preparation done and then having that time management of knowing, hey, look, I've only scheduled 3 interviews. I'm not in a rush to get to the next interview will really help with getting that going. So, Matt, I want to go to you because now, you know, there's kind of this crossroads, because on the SIU side, and you've seen that both here at Advise in prepping for things, but certainly at the UPIC, where testimony was a frequent piece of the puzzle. And I will caveat that by saying, you know, here at Advise in 2017, after CMS said that they were no longer going to support providing subject matter experts for trial purposes through CMS directly, it was relegated down to the UPICs, right? So each UPIC had designated people. We here at Advise actually have one of the handful of people at the time, Lori McMillan, RN, CPC. She was one of a handful of people around the country who was designated by CMS to provide an opinion about CMS. So she can, as an expert and as a qualified expert, she can testify to what CMS's intent and opinion and thoughts are. And so as a qualified expert, she gets to do that. And even now today, she's testified in a number of trials where she gets qualified as an expert, and experts in the trial world are the only people really that get to provide an opinion about things versus a factual statement, right? So factually, if we were to say, you know, what color is Wade's shirt, we would say it looks like it's red. But if we brought in an art connoisseur who was qualified as an expert, they would then say, well, it's not really red, it's this, and this is why, right? Experts get to provide opinions about why they said something. But Matt, the big thing is that when you're getting ready for a trial is 2 big pieces of the puzzle. It's the prep and then the actual testimony, right? And so that's where preparation becomes the most important part, because it doesn't matter if you're testifying it matters who your audience is, deposition, ALJ for a hearing or a trial, but the process is relatively the same.
Correct. And I'm just going to follow up a little bit on what Wade said in terms of, you know, you're prepping and documenting the interview as if it's going to be presented at trial. An investigator should be preparing their case and documenting their case and investigating their case with the presumption that at some point this may be me testifying to what I'm doing at trial. So documenting the case for that. investigating the case for that, writing summary notes in your case file to show the progress of the case and the steps that were taken and why they were taken and the results, telling that story as the case goes along, knowing that at some point you may be presenting that to a grand jury, to an ALJ, to a judge and a jury, so that that preparation goes not from 2 weeks before the trial starts, it starts from day one of the investigation. And then when it was, as it gets closer to the to the actual trial or the hearing, then you start preparing those specific pieces of evidence that you know are going to be the case in chief that you're going to be talking about, whether it's specific interviews, specific facts that you've obtained through data analysis, medical review, or interview that you're going to be testifying about. And it's prepping that information and knowing it backwards and forwards so that you understand it completely, you're able to articulate it clearly to whatever audience it may be, and you can anticipate to some degree the questions that are going to be raised by the other side in terms of, why did you do this? Isn't it true that you'd be able to answer those things because you have prepared that case in such a forthright manner that those questions are going to be more easily answered. So, it's preparation is, short term, but it's also long term.
Right. And that gets back to, Jason, I want to go back to you for kind of the final word as we get ready to wrap up, which is, when I started as an agent, one of the many pieces of advice that you would give is that you've always got to think about the fact that whatever you're investigating, if it goes the distance, you've always got to think in terms of a trial, that you're always thinking in terms of whatever it is that you're doing is going to lead to someone wanting to go to a trial. And whether that be a criminal, a civil, in the SIU world, an ALJ, it could also go to court. I mean, you never know. What are some of the things that you consider when you're, in that mindset, right? We talk a lot about the interview reports, but other pieces of evidence, things that become exhibits, right? When you're doing anything that is going to ultimately, with the thought of there being a criminal, a civil, an administrative trial, how do you track all of those things, right? It could be an interview report. It could be a provider application, an in-network agreement. How do you keep track of all of those things to keep your mind on the prize, which is whatever that resolution is, as part of that preparation?
Well, it's certainly about planning an effective and efficient investigation. And as has already been said, what is it that you're trying to prove? So most likely there's an element of intent. So you have to be thinking about culling out the facts that you've developed, or I should say have found, that prove the pieces of the allegation that you're working on. But the other thing is that I can only imagine what trial exhibits could look like today. So, and I don't mean to make this only about like ancient war stories that have no bearing. But I think some of them do have a bearing because it just really opens your eyes and mind to methodologies of presenting your information. So I'll say one thought I had while thinking about this is don't wear a silk tie when you're using spray adhesives to create a map with push pins in it. And yes, everyone can have fun saying what an old dude that guy is, but the point is that, as the proverb goes, a picture is worth a thousand words. And then the first time I saw an AUSA use PowerPoint, the judge had said it was, of course, because it was related to healthcare, the issues were somewhat complex and voluminous. And the judge said, you have 1 hour for your closing argument. And it was like, no way, like that this 4-year-long investigation was going to be summed up in 1 hour. Well, this gentleman did it in flying colors through the use of back then this newfangled PowerPoint. So now PowerPoint is somewhat antiquated, but the point is more that think about what way can you illustrate the facts that the people that were not able to get out of jury duty and are sitting there can understand these complex facts and the voluminous amount of information that you have to present. So planning your investigation and then planning how you're going to present it at the, you know, when you get closer to that that event is going to be key. One last thing that I really do want to say, and of course you're there to tell the truth, but it's okay to say, I don't know, or especially if you're not an expert, because keeping in mind that as an investigator, you may or may not be an expert, right? I mean, maybe you're doing it for 3 years and now, you know, you're there to present, you know, the interviews that you conducted or something of that nature. So, but do not, and I'm not talking about misrepresenting or not telling the truth. I'm just saying that you want to be clear and it's okay to say, I don't know the answer to that question. So that it doesn't make you the expert that maybe you even want to be someday.
Yeah, that's an important point. Now, you know, particularly when we're talking about preparing for a trial or a hearing or something like that, you know, generally speaking, you're going to know the questions and the answers to at least 50% of the conversation, right? You're not going to know the questions to those that are posed by opposing counsel. And hopefully you'll know the answers to those questions, but you should certainly, you know, be prepared to do that. I will tell you that on, you know, last year, I think I did 6 or 8 expert reports and was deposed in nearly all of them. And oftentimes I was asked questions that were outside of what the scope of my expert engagement was. And so my answer oftentimes was, I don't have the answer to that. And the opposing counsel would say, well, Mr. Rubenstein, you were hired as an expert. How do you not know the answer? Well, because I'm not omnipotent and my engagement was limited to these 3 things. I didn't look at these 7 things, right? So that is an important piece. I'll give one final comment on PowerPoint, which is if you are looking to create a PowerPoint or something similar for what the lawyers love to call a demonstrative, right? To demonstrate or to bring something home, whether it be a summary of a PowerPoint or something along those lines, it is important that you speak to your in-house attorney or your retained attorneys or whoever it is that you're working in the SIU space. It's your general counsel, whoever it is that you're working with, is making sure that you're putting together things that they're approving of, because in the world, particularly in the world of administrative and civil remedies, there is a huge volume of things that are called discovery that you have to turn over, including things like a PowerPoint that's a demonstrative. And so you want to be careful about what sort of pen to paper, so to speak, you're putting together outside of in the normal course of business. Right. Your interview reports are one thing, but if you're creating things and making things on the fly to kind of drive your point home, you certainly want to have counsel and, you know, your lawyers involved with some of those discussions so that you're not doing that. Because if you created something for the purposes of driving a point home and your lawyers go back and say, yeah, that's too much information or it's this or it's that, you can't just go and destroy it. It's part of your record. It's part of your investigative case file. And so it is, you know, potentially something that you're going to want to get vetted out beforehand, which is, you know, in the same vein of whether or not you create a investigative summary or memorandum of investigation. Those are the kind of things that you want to speak to your in-house attorneys, check your policies and see, do you even have, you know, is that even a thing or not? Because you don't want to be in a position where you're creating things that are bringing other factors in that maybe are partly not necessarily made up out of the ether, but just based upon your experience, your common knowledge, and the sort. So be very cautious about creating things for the purposes of demonstration purposes. So look, I think we're gonna keep up a lot of this conversation. I think we've got a lot more to talk about, things like just, you know, the sentencing phase or the adjudication phase. We do want to talk a little bit about, at least particularly in the federal system, the use of the U.S. sentencing guidelines and probation reports. I think a lot of people in the SIU space don't fully understand the important value that an SIU investigation can have as it relates to the sentencing of federal defendants in cases and the like. So I think we're gonna spend some time talking about some things like loss calculations, actual intended, and things of that sort. So again, always great to see you guys. It's good to see that at least three of us are in the advised conference room. Jason, we are working on getting you out of the basement. I hope to have that soon, at least by spring. You do deserve to be. Nobody puts baby in a corner, so you do deserve to be out of the basement. Again, thanks for tuning into this episode. If you are not getting our newsletter, again, we encourage you, hello@advizehealth.com. Get us on LinkedIn. Please hit that button to say follow so you can get all of our daily and weekly content, including our LinkedIn Live notifications and the like. And again, the 18th of October next week, Julie Janeway, our general counsel, 30 years in the healthcare, fraud, waste, abuse, compliance space, civil work, regulatory lawyer, is going to be doing a LinkedIn Live with me. We're going to be talking about compliance as a culture. And we've got a couple other really exciting LinkedIn Lives that are in the process of being scheduled for the rest of the year. So as always, we enjoy having this time that we get to spend with you. Look forward to more of the OIG roundtables with you, and we'll see you on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you.